From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the first time America covertly overthrew a foreign government, the 1953 coup in Iran, in which the CIA overthrew Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. We talk with New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men. It's about the coup that put an end to democratic rule in Iran, brought back the Shah, resulted in the Islamic Revolution of 1979, and helped set the stage for anti-American terrorism. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by trumpeter Terrell Stafford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An explosion in Iraq killed a U.S. soldier and wounded three others today in the latest suspected guerrilla attack. The BBC's Mike Donkin reports from Baghdad.
One vehicle from the heavily armored convoy had stopped under a road bridge in central Baghdad to collect water when it was hit. A grenade struck it as the occupants sat inside. One soldier was killed instantly by the explosion and two were wounded, one it's thought very seriously. Some reports said the grenade was dropped from the bridge, others that it was rocket-propelled. This is the latest incident in what's been a bloody week since American troops killed Saddam Hussein's two sons. That was a huge confidence boost to them. But the attrition since has now prompted U.S. military leaders to reassess the resistance they're getting.
The BBC's Mike Donkin in Baghdad. Liberian refugees are reported to be streaming out of the country's second-largest city, Buchanan, which is now in the hands of rebel soldiers. Many of the refugees had earlier fled Monrovia, which is currently under a rebel siege. Forces loyal to Liberian President Charles Taylor say they're planning a counterattack to recapture the city. The latest fighting came as the State Department sent a top diplomat to Ghana to discuss a possible U.S. role in supporting an international peacekeeping force in Liberia. President Bush has ordered U.S. Marines to be deployed off the Liberian coast so they'll be ready for a support mission. Meanwhile, civilians in the country are reported to be in severe distress with little food, shelter, or safe drinking water. 12 western states are now reporting close to 40 major wildfires. The most dangerous blazes are in Montana, where fire officials are considering a risky maneuver to protect homes and buildings in Glacier National Park. NPR's Howard Berkus has details.
Three major fires are burning in and near the western half of Glacier National Park, threatening lodges, stores, homes, and park headquarters. 5,000 people have been evacuated. Crews are busy clearing fire breaks around buildings. Fire managers are considering setting their own fire to 2,000 acres of forest to create a buffer zone between the buildings and the wildfires. But high heat, low humidity, and shifting winds make that risky. The flames in Montana and 11 other states have the nation's firefighting corps at its highest level of preparedness. There are shortages in fire safety officers and bosses for helicopter crews. There's still a lot less wildfire now than this time last year or in average years, but fire potential is very high to extreme in 15 western states. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points to close at 9,266 in active trading of almost 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 4 points. It closed at 1,735. This is NPR News. The National Review Board of Lay Catholics, which is monitoring church sexual abuse, continues its meeting in Chicago. Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports that the committee is working with less than a full complement of members.
Former Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating resigned as chair of the board last month following a tumultuous year of headbutting with some high-profile bishops and cardinals. The committee is now led by interim chair Ann Burke, an Illinois appellate court judge. Other high-profile members of the board include Robert Bennett, lead counsel for President Clinton during his impeachment, and former Clinton chief of staff Leon Panetta. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops created the National Review Board last summer as part of the Charter for the Protection of Children and Young People. The board oversees the work of the Bishop's Office of Child and Youth Protection and has commissioned studies of the nature, scope, causes, and context of clergy sex abuse. The National Review Board is expected to issue a progress report on its work Tuesday afternoon. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
Comedian Bob Hope has died at his home near Los Angeles. Hope, who recently celebrated his 100th birthday, died from pneumonia. During his long career, Hope was a star of vaudeville, Broadway, radio, movies, and television. He made more than 50 movies, but as host of the Oscar presentations, he liked to joke that none of them had won.
Welcome to the Academy Awards, or as it's known at my house, Passover.
Although his acting may have been passed over, Hope won 5 special Oscars during his career. His best-remembered movies include the series of road comedies with singer Bing Crosby, beginning with The Road to Singapore in 1940. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3, the newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Iranian hostage crisis of 1979 was the first clue most Americans had that we were despised in part of the Middle East. My guest Stephen Kinzer has written a new book about the event that created the anti-Americanism that led to the Iranian hostage crisis. Kinzer's book, All the Shah's Men, is about the 1953 coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and reinstalled the Shah. The coup was orchestrated by British and American intelligence under Winston Churchill and Dwight Eisenhower. It was the first time the U.S. overthrew a foreign government, and Kinzer says it set a pattern for other covert actions in the years to come. Stephen Kinzer is a New York Times correspondent who has reported from more than 50 countries. He's also the author of books about Turkey and the American coup in Guatemala. I asked him to explain how the anti-American sentiments behind the Iranian hostage crisis of 79 connects to 1953, when America covertly overthrew the Iranian prime minister.
The epigram for my book is a line from Harry Truman, who turns out to be one of the heroes in the book. He said, "The only thing new in this world is the history you do not know." That certainly applies in the case of Iran. When the Iranian militants who led the Islamic Revolution of 1979 seized American diplomats as hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, many Americans were shocked. We didn't know what we had done to become the object of such intense hatred by Iranians. The reason we were so shocked is that we didn't know the history of 1953. And that history plays directly into the history of the hostage episode of 1979, 1980, 1981. What happened was that the United States organized a coup in which the Shah of Iran, who had fled the country, was brought back in and reinstalled into power. The coup was organized by intelligence operatives working inside the U.S. Embassy building in Tehran. So if we flash forward 25 years, once again, the Shah has fled, and in fact, he has been admitted into the United States. So, of course, the immediate impulse of many of the young Iranian militants is to think, the same thing is happening again. It's 1953 all over. We get the Shah finally out of the country. Then the Americans conspire to bring him back by using an intelligence operation, the headquarters of which will be at the U.S. Embassy. How do we stop this? We must storm the embassy to prevent 1953 from happening all over again. But that episode, which burns so intensely in the minds of Iranians, is something most Americans are completely unaware of. That's why we were so shocked, both by the hostage episode and by the intense anti-Americanism that came to characterize the Islamic regime in Tehran.
Well, the 1953 coup was staged by the Americans and the British. Let's start with the British relationship with the Iranians and get some of the history leading up to the coup. In 1919, the British imposed the Anglo-Persian Agreement on Iran. What was that agreement?
Essentially, the British imposed an agreement that allowed the British full control over the important levers of power in Iran. This merely formalized an agreement or a system that had been in place for some time by which Britain exercised informal authority through its control over the court of the Qajar dynasty kings. Britain had been the power that dominated Iran. Iran, because of its geography, has always been in the eye of outside powers. And by the time the 20th century dawned, Russia and Britain were the two countries that dominated Iran.
Before World War I, the British took over Iran's oil, and they created the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which later became known as British Petroleum. The British created the world's largest oil refinery in Iran. Why did the British think that they had the right to Iranian oil?
That's a question that really goes to the heart of the ideology of colonialism. Why do big powers think they have a right to the resources of smaller powers? I think the reason was that Britain in the early 20th century was a small island still that required outside injections of profit. And at the beginning of the New Age, particularly through the visionary predictions of young Winston Churchill, who was then a rising military and political figure, the British realized that a revolution was about to change the whole way international politics was conducted, and that was the revolution of the internal combustion engine and oil. Suddenly, oil was going to become the resource that was going to shape world power. The British realized that they didn't have any oil on the British Isles, nor did any of their existing colonies produce oil. Needless to say, the idea that this oil actually belonged to Iran and that if it could not be exploited by Iranians, it might as well just be left in the ground, which was a view that many Iranians held, seemed completely absurd to the British. They went ahead and established an enormous oil company with, as you say, the world's largest refinery that wound up extracting hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil from Iran and giving the Iranians just a pittance in return.
Now, it was after World War II that things started to shift politically in Iran, and there was a movement to get rid of the British, to nationalize the Iranian oil. In 1951, the relationship between Britain and Iran really changed when Mohammad Mossadegh became the prime minister of Iran, and he actually nationalized the oil company. What did Mossadegh stand for politically?
Mossadegh came from an aristocratic family. He was European educated, spoke fluent French, which was the language he conducted his diplomacy in. And he became not just a fervent nationalist, but the leader of the growing group in Iran that focused not only on the British, but on the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company as the source for all of Iran's problems. Iran had this huge and enormously valuable natural resource. Mossadegh and his supporters believed that the money that came from the sale of that resource should naturally be the motor for the development of Iran. It couldn't be that because of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Most of the money was going to England. Therefore, Mossadegh emerged as the prime minister of Iran at the crest of a movement, the principal aim of which was to expel the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company from Iran. Mossadegh went on to do that, and that was the beginning of all his trouble.
What was the British reaction to Mossadegh's attempt to nationalize the oil industry?
First of all, Mossadegh offered to accept international arbitration on this question of who owed how much money to whom after the nationalization. In fact, he offered to conduct the nationalization according to British law. The British were at that time nationalizing their own coal industry and several of their other important domestic industries. So it wasn't just an expropriation. It was to be a negotiated nationalization. Now, after the nationalization was announced, the British were at first very dubious and skeptical that they couldn't believe that this was happening, even as it was well underway. They couldn't believe that some little country out in the middle of nowhere, which was their stereotype of Iran, would stand up to Britain and rob the British people of a resource that the British considered essential to their stability and development and prosperity. slowly it became clear that Mossadegh was indeed in deadly earnest. The British decided, and this was a reasonable impulse based on their history in Iran, that they would overthrow him. They assigned their intelligence agents at the British embassy in Tehran to begin organizing a coup against Mossadegh. He got wind of this and did the one thing that he could have done to save himself. He closed the British embassy, and he sent all the British diplomats home. Among those diplomats were the intelligence operatives who had been assigned to overthrow Mossadegh. Therefore, the British suddenly find themselves with their oil company being nationalized and no agents on the ground to carry out what they considered to be the logical response, which was overthrowing the nationalizing government. The British then appealed to the United States. Harry Truman was president. And the British came to him and said, first of all, we want to launch an invasion of Iran. We're going to have a military action. Truman and Dean Acheson, who was his Secretary of State, went nuts when they heard that. And they made it very clear to the British that they could never support a British invasion of Iran to seize the oil fields and the refinery back. Then the British had a second proposal. Why don't you send some of your CIA agents over to Iran and overthrow Mossadegh for us? Truman wouldn't hear any of that either. The United States at this point had never overthrown a government. Truman was very reluctant to break that precedent. He believed that overthrowing regimes can have very complicated long-term effects, and it was just not something the United States should get involved in doing.
So President Truman did not want to go along with the British in overthrowing the government of Iran, but then Dwight Eisenhower was elected president, and he and his administration were more open to the idea. What was their interest? What was the Eisenhower administration's interest in working with the British to overthrow the Mossadegh government in Iran?
The British saw immediately that there was a change in tone as the new Republican administration was coming into office. Even before Eisenhower had been inaugurated, the British sent one of their senior intelligence operatives to Washington to meet with the incoming team. And the head of this delegation, who had been the former director of the British intelligence in Iran, wrote later in a memoir that as he was preparing his presentation to the Eisenhower administration, he realized, we can't ask the Americans, go to Iran and overthrow Mossadegh because he has taken our oil company. This just was not an argument that was going to excite many people in Washington. So he said, I had to come up with another argument. And knowing the tenor of the administration and the people who were coming into positions of power, I decided to make the argument that Mossadegh was opening Iran to the possibility of a communist takeover. That was the argument that he did indeed make, and that was the argument that the Americans embraced when, under the Eisenhower administration, they agreed to collaborate with the British, send their own agents into Iran, and carry out the overthrow. There's a great argument, which I don't think we can ever answer today, as to how seriously Russia was looking at Iran as a target for a possible takeover. We'll probably never know that. But I do think we can say this. The world looked very ominous from the eyes of the Eisenhower administration. Then as now, the United States saw itself facing a vicious global enemy. The Eisenhower administration came in with the sense that the previous administration, the Democrats under Truman, had not done enough to fight communism and to pull America out of what Richard Nixon called the Dean Acheson College of Cowardly Communist Containment. The Secretary of State Dulles and his brother, the CIA director, felt that they needed to strike out somewhere quickly to show the world that the United States was on the offensive, that we weren't going to sit back and watch more communist expansion. It wasn't possible for the United States to turn the tide of revolution in China, for example, or to roll back communist takeovers in Eastern Europe. Iran seemed to them like a good stage on which they could mount an action that would show the world that the United States was taking an active offensive role against what it saw as a great threat.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer. His new book, All the Shah's Men, is about how the United States and Britain collaborated to overthrow the prime minister of Iran in 1953, Mohammad Mossadegh, and what the repercussions of that event were. One of the figures, one of the leading figures in the American efforts to overthrow Mossadegh was Norman Schwarzkopf's father, H. Norman Schwarzkopf. So the father of the commander of Gulf War I played a key role in the overthrow of the Iranian government in 1953. What was his role?
The cast of characters in this story is quite remarkable, and General Schwarzkopf is just one of them. General Schwarzkopf had left the U.S. Army and become the commander of the New Jersey State Police. And he became a nationally famous figure for directing the investigation into the Lindbergh kidnapping. He then parlayed that celebrity into radio stardom. He became the radio voice of Gangbusters, which was a very famous crime show back in the 1940s. Now, General Schwarzkopf re-enlisted in the Army or returned to active duty during World War II, and he was sent to Iran to transform a ragtag Royal Guard into a crack military unit. This he did with great success and gusto. The unit that he commanded, which was a kind of police-slash-military unit, was the scourge of dissidents and bandits also all over Iran. And was also a great symbol of the rising American power there. Up until this point, the United States had very little to do with Iran. But Schwarzkopf was really the first flamboyant American to become a great figure in Iran. Later on, in 1953, when the United States decided it wanted to do the bidding of the British and carry out the coup against Mossadegh, one of the first challenges that American agents faced was the challenge of recruiting the young Mohammad Reza Shah. Now, we think back on the Shah of Iran, those of us who are old enough to remember him, as a very strong and harsh figure. But actually, as a young man, he was very timid, and very indecisive, and very frightened. He didn't want to get involved with this project. And the United States had to use several levers to persuade him. One of the things they did was they called General Schwarzkopf and set up a cover mission for him of visiting countries in the Middle East and Central Asia. The true center of his mission was to go to Iran, carry a lot of cash for the coup plotters, and then go to visit the Shah, who would, of course, have remembered General Schwarzkopf as a huge figure in the court when he was a young boy, and essentially strong-arm him, tell him you have no choice, the United States is going to go ahead with this coup, and you must get on board.
Let's talk about the strategy for the coup. First, there was a disinformation campaign in the press and in the mosques to turn the public against Prime Minister Mossadegh. What were some of the things that were printed? What was some of the disinformation that was disseminated, and how did the CIA do it?
First of all, most of the newspapers in Tehran were on the payroll of either the British or American intelligence agencies. That included editors, reporters, and columnists. So there was not only no difficulty in inserting false material into the Iranian press, but there was an eagerness and a willingness on a part of editors who were on the British and American payroll to print this stuff. In fact, there was so much demand for it and so much space for it that the Iranians who were churning this stuff out couldn't churn out enough of it. There were also agents working overtime in Washington, writing articles saying that Mossadegh was a secret communist, that he was making deals with the Soviet Union, that he was plotting to destroy the monarchy, that he wanted to make himself the king.
That his parents were Jewish. That was one of them you mentioned.
And he was a homosexual.
Uh-huh.
Both of which were crimes that could lead to death penalty under certain legal codes in Iran. So it was a very intense political campaign that was carried out not just in the press, but as you said, also in the mosques, since there were a number of mullahs who were also on the payroll of these intelligence agencies.
Now, another part of the pre-coup campaign was the CIA paid thugs to form mobs and take over the street. And some of them were supposed to shout their allegiance to communism and to Mossadegh. What was the logic behind that?
The American agent that was sent to Iran to carry out this coup carried with him a fairly thick and well-elaborated plan that the British and the Americans had put together jointly. One of the things they wanted to do was to convey the sense that Iran was slipping into chaos, that there was no law and order anymore. An important way that they did this was to pay mobs that ran through the streets, smashing shop windows, tearing down statues of the Shah, shooting into mosques, and then shouting, "We love Mossadegh and communism." This was a way to alarm people and make people think that Mossadegh's partisans were wildly violent fanatics. In fact, those were people that were being paid by the CIA.
Now, while the CIA was paying thugs to create social and political disorder in the streets through these unruly, sometimes violent demonstrations, you say that Prime Minister Mossadegh naively ordered the police not to interfere with the demonstrations because he wanted to ensure that the Iranian people had the right to protest and to demonstrate.
Mossadegh was a real committed Democrat. Even some of his own supporters urged him to try to crack down on some of the newspapers that were obviously printing CIA propaganda, to close down radio stations or political groups that were spreading lies or sending out thugs onto the street. But I say naively, he believed that democracy was finally flowering in Iran, and it was his responsibility to allow it to flower. Bear in mind, of course, that he had no idea that the Americans had actually sent people into Iran who were living in Tehran at that moment with the sole goal of overthrowing his government. He didn't realize what was happening around him. And his refusal to crack down on even the most irresponsible opposition groups played right into the hands of the people that were trying to overthrow him.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Days of the Dead, a novel of suspense by Barbara Hambly, author of Wet Grave. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Stephen Kinzer about the CIA-backed coup that overthrew Iran's democratically elected prime minister in 1953. We'll hear about the thugs the CIA paid to demonstrate and create havoc in the streets. And Kevin Whitehead reviews New Beginnings, the latest CD by trumpeter Terrell Stafford. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with New York Times correspondent Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. It's about how American and British intelligence under Dwight Eisenhower and Winston Churchill staged a 1953 coup in Iran that overthrew the democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, and reinstalled the Shah. Kinzer says the coup resulted in anti-American sentiments that set the stage for the Iranian Revolution of 1979 and future anti-American terrorism. One of the key players in the coup on the Iranian side was General Zahedi, who was told that he'd be the new prime minister after Mossadegh was deposed. What did the American and the British want from him in return?
The most important thing that the outside world expected was a resolution of the oil problem. Despite the fact that the Americans were very concerned about what they saw, somewhat legitimately, somewhat with exaggeration, as rising communist influence, the crucial basis for this coup was oil. Without oil, there never would have been a coup there. So the first thing that the Western powers wanted was a restoration of the Anglo-Iranian oil company to its previous position of absolute power in Iran. That didn't happen. One of the reasons it didn't happen was that the Americans gently turned to the British and said, look, we did the dirty work. We overthrew that government for you. So we and our oil companies should also have a piece of that Iranian pie. As a result of that argument, a new consortium was developed in which 60% of the new Iran oil company was to belong to the British, and the rest was to be distributed among the Americans and European companies. So although the Zahedi government did not return to the status quo, it did annul the nationalization of the oil company effectively and return control of the oil industry to foreigners.
I guess you could say the coup officially started when a colonel who was the commander of the Imperial Guard carried a decree from the Shah dismissing Mossadegh from office. Tell us a little bit about what happened at that moment.
The Americans who were arranging the coup had decided that the way to do it was to get a letter from the Shah firing Mossadegh as prime minister. This was a mechanism of quite dubious legality, since only the parliament was allowed to hire and fire prime ministers. Nonetheless, the Shah and the institution of the monarchy had some credibility in Iran, so this document was a crucial part of the coup planning. The Shah was at first reluctant to sign it, which is why General Schwarzkopf and others were sent in to twist his arm, but he finally did. And on the night of August 16th, 1953, the Iranian officer who the Americans had selected for this task showed up at Mossadegh's house with this decree dismissing him from office. Unfortunately, the coup had been betrayed. Some other officers and other soldiers were waiting for this officer, and they arrested him. As a result, all the planning that had gone on for months was suddenly worthless. The coup plotters were arrested. Zahedi had to flee into hiding. The Shah immediately left the country, and the CIA leaders in Washington were sending urgent telegrams to their chief of station in Tehran, telling him, you better get out of there before they find you and kill you. So it looked at that moment as though the entire operation had failed.
But it hadn't. How did it turn around again in favor of the American and the British?
This was an era when CIA agents operated really by their own wits. There was no instantaneous communication between field officers and the headquarters back in Washington. So Kermit Roosevelt, who was the CIA agent in charge on the ground, decided the next morning, I think I can still do this. The old plan didn't work, but I came here to overthrow a government, and I don't want to leave until I've got the job done. So in the period of just a few hours, he reactivated his mobs. He figured out which of his plotters were still out of jail, and he announced to his own CIA staff, we're going to do this again 3 days from now. And that's what they did. Mossadegh, thinking the danger was over, since an attempted coup had been crushed, took all the pressure off and didn't even talk about a crackdown on those people he knew had been involved in the coup. He thought that with the Shah gone, all the danger was past. He had no idea that there was a coterie of very intense intelligence agents working out of the U.S. embassy that were not going to stop working until he was overthrown.
And we should mention that Kermit Roosevelt, who you were talking about, was the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, is it?
Yes, yes. Talk about colorful characters.
Do you have any idea what the crowd must have looked like on the day of the actual coup? When you know, the crowd mostly of thugs who were paid off by the CIA.
You had quite a mixed crowd. First of all, I'd say it was quite large, and it grew in size as the day passed. That's the day of August 19th, 1953, the day when the coup finally succeeded. It started out with a certain core, and that core consisted of thugs from the bazaar and members of mobs for hire groups, let's say, and then finally...
Mobs are us.
Very... Actually, that phrase has been used by some of the historians of the coup. In addition, the coup plotters recruited one very bizarre and extraordinary group. Iran has a tradition of physical culture that has allowed the growth of a number of very exotic athletic societies in which men not only build up their muscles very, very intensely, but learn skills like juggling and knife throwing. They really are quite fearsome, and they would turn out for parades of various sorts. The CIA group that was organizing this coup hired these athletic societies. And so in addition to these thugs, and then I think lots of ordinary people who gathered them as the day went on and the air became kind of festive and celebratory, you had these very barrel-chested men with enormous biceps, many of them wearing just loincloths and carrying knives, sticks, and heavy clubs, and some of them juggling heavy objects. So you had really a mixed crowd, a very unusual, very large one, which towards the end of the day was joined by police and military units who had been paid off by CIA agents to do just that. So it started out from the bazaar, the poorer neighborhoods of Tehran. It swelled in size as the day went on, including with the addition of many people who had no idea that this was an operation being sponsored by a foreign government. And then it was given decisive firepower by the arrival of military and police commanders with their men and heavy weapons.
Mossadegh was charged with treason for having resisted the Shah's dismissal order and for inciting the people to armed insurrection. He was given a military trial, sentenced to 3 years in prison, and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. He died in 1965 at the age of 85. Did he die knowing the truth that he was overthrown basically by the CIA? Did he know that?
He knew that he had been overthrown with the active cooperation of foreign intelligence services. I do think that if he could come back to life and read my book, he'd learn a lot that he didn't know. There was no way that he or anyone else in Iran could have known all this stuff at that time. It has been a very slow process for the real story of the 1953 coup to leak out. And Mossadegh certainly died without knowing some of the most important chapters in that story.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, All the Shah's Men. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer. His new book, All the Shah's Men, is about the 1953 coup in Iran that overthrew the democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. The coup was orchestrated by the Americans and the British. What did the Americans finally get out of the coup? They put their man, you know, the Shah and the military general in power. What did they get?
We got a lot of pain and a lot of trouble over many years. This was an operation that seemed successful in its immediate aftermath. We had gotten rid of a guy we didn't like, and we had installed a guy we did like. The guy we did like, the Shah, remained in power for 25 years and consolidated an increasingly brutal and corrupt dictatorship. That dictatorship led to the explosion of anger that we call the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Actually, many of the people marching in those protests that in that 1979 revolution carried pictures of Mossadegh. What they were saying with those pictures is, we don't want outside intervention anymore. We don't want Americans and British in here telling us what to do. We want to decide our own destiny. So then we began to think maybe we didn't get such a good deal out of this after all. As we look back at it from the perspective of today, it looks even more horrific because the Islamic regime that took power in Iran, coming to power on the crest of this anti-Shah explosion, turned out to be fanatically anti-American, violently anti-Western. It has been implicated in some of the most deadly terrorist attacks against American citizens. Not only that, but the coming to power of this Islamic regime was a real turning point for many religious fanatics in other Muslim countries. They looked at Iran and they began to say to themselves, we don't just have to be a faction on the margins of society. We don't have to be criticizing the political establishment from our niches in the mosques. We can take over. We can be the government. We can be countries. This was a lightning bolt that came out of Iran. It led, among other things, to the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Taliban have no use for the Iranian Shiites, but they were inspired by this example of religious devotees coming to power. So their coming to power and the terrorists to whom they gave shelter in Afghanistan can be counted as a collateral result of what we did in Iran in 1953.
Okay, so in the long term, the results don't look very good. In the short term, what was the moral of the story that the CIA interpreted?
When Kermit Roosevelt, the CIA agent who had orchestrated this coup in Iran, came back to Washington to give his briefing to the Secretary of State, the CIA director, and the president, he noticed that the people to whom he was speaking were very excited at what they saw as a new instrument for American power in the world, and that was the covert replacement of regimes. Suddenly, the culture of covert action seized control of the American body politic. You can trace that phenomenon right back to the 1953 coup. This was such a success at such seemingly low cost that the United States went on to do it again the next year in Guatemala. That was another operation that seemed successful at the time, but over the decades that followed, resulted in the massacre of hundreds of thousands of innocent Guatemalan peasants. At the time, these seemed like very low-cost ways of achieving American goals in the world. It was the Iran coup of 1953 that really got the higher level of the U.S. government to thinking that coups, covert action, was really a good way for the United States to shape world politics.
You actually wrote a book a few years ago about the CIA-backed coup in Guatemala. Were there things that you could say for sure that the CIA considered lessons from the Iranian coup that they applied to the Guatemala coup?
The first lesson they learned was how easy it can be for a rich, powerful, developed country with a highly sophisticated intelligence agency to throw a small country into upheaval. They realized that this was something that could be done with relative ease, and the way they did it in Guatemala was the same thing. They stitched together a few hapless exiles and pretended they were an army and arranged fake radio transmissions and sowed all sorts of discontent among the population. This is a formula that, with variations, went on to be used in Chile and Cuba and the Congo and Vietnam and many other countries. So there really was a template taken from Iran, not so much in the precise tactics, but in the realization that a few determined agents and the application of what is for the United States a relatively modest amount of cash can overthrow a government of almost any country in the world and lead to the installation of one that's reliably pro-American.
You mentioned in your book, All the Shah's Men, that some documents about the CIA coup in Iran have only recently become available, such as a CIA history of the coup, which was leaked to the New York Times in the year 2000. What are some of the details that are actually in that CIA history? How explicit is it?
That's quite a sophisticated document. It's almost 100 pages long, and it is essentially a recap of exactly what was done. This tells you how much money was appropriated. It tells you who approved the appropriation of the money, how it was decided to send Americans into Iran, where they were to be operating, who they were supposed to meet. It tells a lot about the different intelligence networks that the British had built in Iran and that were waiting for the American agents when they arrived. And it talks a lot about the process by which military officers in the Iranian army, Iranian politicians, and Iranian religious leaders were bribed into supporting this coup. So this document, partial though it is, and there are parts of it that are censored, tells us a lot that we didn't know before about what happened in 1953. And it's something that I relied on quite a bit when producing this book.
How is the history that you've written about how the CIA overthrew the Iranian government in 1953, how is that history informing the way you see the American presence in Iraq now?
Not everybody sees us the way we see ourselves. That's true for us as individuals. It's also true for us as a nation. Americans think of ourselves as paladins of democracy in the world. Our mission is to liberate oppressed peoples and give them freedom. We don't seem that way to everybody in the world, though. Other people think of us as oppressors, and particularly in Iran, there is a very strong historical basis for this perception. Iran only had a democracy for one very short period in its history. Actually, just to use the word Iran and democracy in the same sentence seems quite bizarre to us in the modern age. But Iran was once a democracy. That democracy came to an end because the United States overthrew it. And for the last 50 years, the people of Iran have had to live under varying forms of tyranny as a result of our coup. Some of the responses that I'm getting from Iranians to my book now really reflect this. They say, as one woman wrote to me, "It brought tears to my eyes to think of what we lost and what we could have had." Put yourself in the position of an Iranian, seeing now the Americans preaching the value of democracy, or put yourself in the shoes of anybody who lives in a country near Iran, who knows the history of the United States in that region. Those people are going to be very dubious when the United States shows up in the guise of a liberator. We see ourselves that way, but we need to realize that not only ignorant people, but also well-informed people in many parts of the world see us very differently, and they have a historical reason for doing so.
Stephen Kinzer, thank you so much for talking with us.
That was a great pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. He's a New York Times correspondent. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by trumpeter Terrell Stafford. This is Fresh Air. Jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford has played with McCoy Tyner, Shirley Scott, Bobby Watson, Matt Wilson, the Clayton Brothers, the Carnegie Hall Jazz Band, and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. He's taught at Juilliard and teaches at Temple University. So, why isn't he famous, as jazz trumpeters go? Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, beats him.
Playing jazz well is hard work, mentally and physically, but it's especially ridiculous on trumpet, which places a superhuman burden on the lips. Maybe that's why some of the best trumpeters sound triumphant, like Terrell Stafford. He gets a fat, beautiful sound all over the horn and subdivides rhythms all sorts of ways that swing from all angles. He knows where he's going, but listens to the band in case they have a better idea, and he sounds like he's having fun without overdoing it. He also plays melodies very well. That's "I Don't Want to Be Kissed by Anyone Else But You," which you might know from Miles Davis's version. It's a sign of Stafford's confidence that he'll play tunes associated with Miles or Chet Baker, knowing he's got his own voice. He's more interested in topping himself than the ancestors. Terrell Stafford takes "The Touch of Your Lips" at a tempo so brisk some musicians would wilt, and keeps building steam from one improvised chorus to the next. Terrell Stafford on his CD New Beginnings from Max Jazz. That sterling rhythm section is Mulgrew Miller on piano, Derek Hodge on bass, and Dana Hall on drums. They're joined here and there by guest saxophonists, the standout being Steve Wilson. He phrases against the grain even when the rhythm section pushes him to go with the flow. On Berta's Bounce, they let him wander, then tug on the leash, then mock his odd accents with a couple of their own before bearing down for the chase. Thank you. I only wish Terrell Stafford's whole record was as good as this stuff. In truth, some other pieces and saxophone solos are sleepier, and there's an iffy version of the old folkmass favorite Kumbaya. But all the snap, crackle, and pop makes that stuff easy to forgive.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed New Beginnings, featuring trumpeter Terrell Stafford on the Max Jazz label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Bob Hope, who has died 2 months after his 100th birthday. He had a great gift for comic timing. His rhythmic timing as a singer was pretty good, too. Here's a 1938 duet with Shirley Ross of the Hoagy Carmichael Frank Lesser song, Two Sleepy People.
Here we are, out of cigarettes, holding hands and yawning, look how late it gets.
Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight. Here we are, in the cozy chair,
picking on a wishbone from the Frigidaire. Two sleepy people with nothing to say,
and too much in love to break away.
Do you remember the nights we used to linger in the hall?
Yeah, Father didn't like you at all.
Whatever happened to him?
Remember the reason why we married in the fall?
To rent this little nest and get a bit of rest.
Well, here we are, just about the same. Foggy little fella,
drowsy little dame. Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.
Here we are. Gee, don't we look a mess?
Lipstick on my collar.
And wrinkles in my dress. Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.
Here we are, crazy in the head. Gee, your eyes are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Even when they're red. Two sleepy people who know very well
they're too much in love to break the spell.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Laura Hillenbrand, the author of Seabiscuit, which is back on top of the bestseller list. She wrote the book while suffering with an extreme case of chronic fatigue syndrome, which she still has. Why would an editor take a chance on an author who was so sick? We'll ask Hillenbrand's editor, Jonathan Karp. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.